is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome, everyone. This is Lana. Thanks for tuning in. This is going to be a great show with my guest, Ayla, who has a YouTube channel called Wife with a Purpose. We're going to discuss her transition from liberal to right, the white culture war, the insanity of feminists and social justice warriors, and also modern problems concerning us white women. Ayla is a stay-at-home, homeschooling mother of five children. She's passionate about European culture, history, and sovereignty. She earned her bachelor's degree in German and also women's studies with a minor in anthropology. She is part of the LDS Church, and so she'll share some pagan elements within the practice as she was a pagan before becoming Mormon. And since she's a homeschooling mother of five, she'll share some tips for other homeschoolers. Ayla, or Wife with a Purpose, coming up. Welcome, Ayla. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So I have to ask, what's your ethnic background? Are you German or English?
I'm a lot. Being American, I am Swiss, German, English, Irish, and then my grandmother's grandmother was Native American. So I've got a little bit of Powhatan Confederacy way back there. And then my husband is Scottish, and so I've kind of taken on that as part of my identity as well. So I typically consider myself just extremely Northern European.
Not a bad thing. So Wife with a Purpose, that's the name of your YouTube channel. So what inspired you to create the channel?
I'm extremely opinionated, and I like being on Twitter to kind of get my opinion out and kind of get things off my chest. And the 140 character limit reins me in a lot. And I actually was giving a talk at my church just a few months ago, and somebody complimented me on my voice and said, "Oh, I could just listen to you all day. You should have a radio show or a podcast or something like this." And so I actually thought about at first trying to start a podcast, but I'm not technology savvy enough to have actually figured out how to do that. And so YouTube was really easy and simple. And so I just thought, well, I'll just start venting on YouTube a little bit, some of my longer opinions that are more complicated and won't fit on Twitter. And so that's kind of how that got started.
Well, you do a great job. And one thing I'm curious about is, tell us about your transition from liberal to conservative. That doesn't happen often.
No, it doesn't. it's a long story, but essentially what happened to me is I was just raised in a very liberal environment. My hometown is Las Vegas, Nevada, and which has obviously a huge liberal influence. I went to an extremely liberal performing arts high school with a lot of liberal ideas, a lot of liberal teachers. Went on to get my undergraduate degree in a liberal arts field. My undergraduate degree is in German with a minor in anthropology. So again, liberal professors, liberal environment. Then went on to get my master's degree in San Francisco, actually. So again,
More liberals. Yep.
Right. So just liberal, liberal, liberal. And they just kind of spoon fed me my whole life, to be quite honest. And I was extremely interested in academia, but I didn't really start doing my own independent research until graduate school. I just kind of accepted what my professors told me, and I kind of just idolized them and their knowledge that I thought that they had, and so I didn't research things. And once I got to grad school and I started researching things independently and actually trying to be more academically rigorous in my own information gathering, that's when things started to crumble for me, both from a point of academia, but then also at the same time, I was very much immersed in this San Francisco culture. And I went to school in San Francisco, but we lived about 3 hours north in a small rural farming community north of San Francisco. And it was kind of where a lot of the hippies of the baby boomer hippies of the 60s had gone to retire. And so it was a little microcosm of like their values and about two or three generations of their values living in this one little area. And so I was very steeply immersed in what actually happens to community when liberalism is the pervasive value structure. And I saw the destruction of that and what it wrought upon families and communities. And so those two things kind of came together to start having me research other other things. And I kind of had always been a traditionalist at heart, was one of the big things. I'd always been pro-life and I'd always been pro-family. I wanted to be a mom. I wanted to be a stay-at-home mom. I wanted to be a homeschooling mother. And those belief systems that I held, even when I was liberal, didn't mesh with liberal politics or liberal society or their ideal of how things should be. And so eventually those core values and belief systems that I had still held on to sort of guided me in the next process to say, no, it's really traditionalism and conservative values that that I actually hold for myself when I'm not just regurgitating what my college professors had told me.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because it seems, you know, a lot of the conservative kids, they go to college and then they come out of school, because it's all just liberals in college everywhere, you know, and then they come out liberals and they think they're so enlightened and so original and better than everyone else. But really, they're just completely brainwashed, don't you think?
Exactly. I completely agree. And I often wonder, had I just gone through the academic portion of it and not got to witness firsthand several generations of extreme liberal values within a community, if I had only gone through the academic portion, I hope that I still would have come to the same conclusions and been able to have been self-aware enough and self-reflecting enough to have done real research and discovered some of the truth behind some of these brainwashing issues that are out there. But it really helped me to see just right in front of my face every day the destructiveness of that value system and what it does to a community.
It's true. And this really, this fake value system of liberalism, it's everywhere. It's in media, it's in entertainment, it's in education. It's really just so mainstream too. So I laugh when these liberal kids think that they're being the counterculture, when it's just like, no, everyone is completely brainwashed in the same ideals right now.
Exactly. Exactly. It's like when I see a young teenage girl with blue or purple hair, and I think that's not original anymore. You know,
no, it's 20 not.
Years ago that was original, but you're not unique anymore when you're doing that. Yeah, it's interesting.
Well, how did you go from pagan to Christian? Since these days, it really does seem to be the reverse. I went from Christian back to, you know, my pre-Christian roots. So how did it happen for you?
Yeah, that's a complicated one too. It's a long story, but essentially what happened with me is I became kind of what I call a Barnes & Noble pagan. Excuse me. I was a Barnes & Noble pagan. I had in my teenage years gone to Barnes & Noble and just kind of bought some books on paganism and read them and decided that's what I wanted to do. And it was very much just the new age version of paganism and the hippie liberal paganism. It wasn't traditional paganism. It wasn't really based on, you know, a lot of actual ancient practices in Europe or European culture. It was more just that hippy dippy, you know, tarot card feelings based thing. And so anyways, it was very similar to my conversion from going from being a liberal to conservative, because I was being a pagan was very much part of my being a liberal, and it was a huge part of my liberalism. And so when I started investigating some of the conservative ideas and getting more into that, it naturally led me to look at my spiritual philosophy and wanting to be more logical about that and be more rigorous about that. And not to say that paganism is illogical. I'm not making that claim. What I am making the claim, though, is that that kind of fake New Age Barnes & Noble paganism is illogical.
Oh, yeah. I agree completely. Yeah.
Right. So it led me to really examine that. And so I got really turned on to professors such as John Lennox and then apologists such as C.S. Lewis. And I really loved their blend of philosophy, theology, mathematics, science, quantum physics. I wanted something that felt really meaty and real, that was more measurable, that was more scientific. And I found that very much in Christianity. However, that having been said, I didn't become a traditional Christian. I didn't become a Catholic or an evangelical Christian. I became a Mormon Christian, which is a huge difference. And a lot of people, of course, Christians, a lot of Christians wouldn't consider me a Christian. They would actually consider me pagan, because a lot of the beliefs within Mormonism match up quite well with paganism. And what was interesting to me was when I was researching paganism and being more rigorous about that, some of those wonderful ancient traditions like seer stones and things like that, shamanic practices that felt authentic and real and had some quantum physics aspects behind it and some reality behind it, for me, felt like reality behind it, were things that I also found within the LDS or the Mormon church. And so those things lended themselves easily to get to the point where I'm at now. And I definitely call myself a Christian, consider myself a Christian, but most Christians would not consider me a Christian.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've heard that before from other Mormons too, saying that there actually is some similarities, some ideas that have been carried from, you know, pagan or pre-Christian times. So what are some of those ideas?
Oh, definitely. Well, the original prophet of the Restoration, as we call him, Joseph Smith, the one who began what we call the Mormon Church back in the mid-1800s, he very much, his life story and his life journey lines up more with like an ancient pagan shaman than it does really a preacher, a Baptist preacher, or a priest, or one of these sorts of Christian figures. He was born on a full moon. He was born in the Call, which means he was born with his with the embryonic sac still intact. He came out completely intact, and that's in paganism considered that person has got a little bit of the veil between the worlds is a little thinner for that person, and they have they're better in tune with spiritual matters. And in fact, his father, Joseph Smith's father, had saved part of his embryonic sac and dried it out as kind of a talisman. And his mother was a palm reader and a little bit of ritual magic here and there. His father was a universalist. Went to the Universalist Church. Anyways, I could go on and on. The way he translated the Book of Mormon is very fascinating because he used seer stones, which were stones that were procured under kind of a shamanic journey that you take in nature. They're river stones that have been naturally worn by water. And that lines up with a lot of ancient Celtic beliefs about how to peer into what they would call the fairy world. And then Another aspect would be, of course, the Mormon temples have pentagrams on them. Mm-hmm. Anyways, I actually could go, that could be an entire episode in and of itself. One of the big things, though, that drew me was the concept of Heavenly Mother. So Mormons are Christians that believe we have a Heavenly Father, but we have a Heavenly Mother as well. And we quite often reference our Heavenly Parents as being, we're spirit children of our Heavenly Parents. And that sets us apart from a lot of mainstream Christianity. And that for me was a big deal because I had just a very strong personal testimony of there being a divine feminine. And that's been a huge part of my life and my spiritual journey. So that resonated really well with me. And actually, when some of my pagan friends would criticize me for joining what they consider to be a Christian tradition, I said, I'm joining the largest church in the world with 14 million worldwide members that believes in a goddess. So don't call me down on that side of it. You know, call me down.
I like that because a lot of, Christianity has been very male oriented, whereas our ancestors weren't like that. They honored both the masculine and the feminine. You know, they had their deities that were both female and male. So I like that. It's an interesting aspect to it.
Yeah, me too.
So I have to ask, are you noticing the all out attack on white people, on culture and ancestors in America? I mean, what are your thoughts about this?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I've noticed it since I was a teenager back in the 90s when I was in high school. I was in an international studies program in high school, so I was studying foreign languages, and I've always been a culture junkie and a language junkie and a religion junkie. I love studying all of those different things worldwide. And I noticed that it was always totally fine to have clubs and organizations centered around Black youth, Latino youth. We could have Asian Island Pacificer Month. But the second you started talking about white heritage or white culture, whether that was German, Irish, French, it seemed to me that was for everyone. That was accessible for everyone. So, for example, I wouldn't be able to join an African American literature class. And in fact, in college, I asked to join an African American literature class simply because I was fascinated with the cultural aspect mm-hmm. of it. I wanted to know what they were studying. What were they reading? What how did they feel? I was told by the professor essentially that I wasn't allowed to. I was white. But when it came to things like German Club, both in high school and college, which I was very active in, German Club was for everyone. German Club wasn't just for white kids or kids with German heritage. It was just about language only. It was specifically about the language, and then maybe some beer and some bratwurst, and that was about it. And anyone could join, but that wasn't true of the other communities and cultures. And I always felt quite slighted as a young person, particularly being a white middle class American girl of a mixed European heritage. I wasn't just Irish or just German or just Swiss. I couldn't hold on to just the one. I kind of wanted a white culture and a white identity, but I was told, over and over again, of course, that wasn't allowed. I mean, in fact, the very fact that I even got my bachelor's degree in German cast bad glances my way.
Like you're a Nazi or something,
some people,
right?
Exactly. With a Jewish woman at one point who, when she found out my major in college was German, would basically not speak to me anymore. And I said,
geez.
Studying the language and the literature, I'm not, joining the SS. I don't understand your perspective. And then obviously their history there is complicated, but I always thought, well, it's very interesting that it's perfectly fine to dump on white culture and white identity and to not allow them to have that identity unless it's a joke. And it's just amped up since the social justice warrior movement came along, and we all have to be victims, and there has to be something that's evil. And of course, white people and white males, they've become what our society has decided is evil.
Yeah.
Keeping mm-hmm. them down, and it allows people not to take personal responsibility for themselves or their communities, and to just to blame whitey. And unfortunately, white people, we've gone right along with it for the most part. We've gone ahead and accepted this notion of white guilt, and that's where we're at today.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, white culture for everyone, and it's becoming that way with countries too. I've traveled around to many European countries, and it's, Africans can have Africa, Asians can have Asia, but white countries are for everyone, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And I've had that personal experience myself, in that I have very close family friends over in France. And so growing up, I went over there with my grandmother and an aunt, and I went and spent time with them. And I remember in France in the late 1990s, they had a Muslim population, obviously, but it was mostly domestic servants, maids in your hotel or whatever. And over where I was living in the southwest of America, we had a similar situation where we had Latino immigration. But again, it was fairly small even still at that point. And they were mostly domestic servants working as maids in hotels and et cetera. And it was interesting to me to flash forward 15 years later and look at how both those populations in both of our countries have absolutely exploded and taken over. And I live in a very small rural town in Utah, and half of my block that I live on is Latino.
Really?
Yes. And, when you think Utah, you think about as white as they come.
Yeah. I thought that was Mormon land.
Yeah, it is. But it's very interesting how it's just exploded everywhere. And my father's family is from Tennessee. And I remember being a little girl and them talking about how, we have a Mexican now in our neighborhood. And that was considered an anomaly. There just weren't Mexicans in Tennessee. You had Mexicans in California, you had them in Arizona, you didn't have them in Tennessee. And now there's entire neighborhoods in the South, in Tennessee, Virginia, that are completely Hispanic, and with their own markets and everything, and they've just really taken over. And so I noticed that the similarities, and of course with the refugee crisis that's going on in Europe, which was kind of my personal last straw as far as not being more outspoken about white culture and white pride and wanting to preserve my culture and my heritage. And I look at my five children and think, what are they going to have to look to? Where are they going to have to? I mean, I was allowed to go. I was able to go to Europe, and I was able to visit, and I was able to see where my people came from. And are my children even going to have that opportunity? Is there going to be a white homeland for my children once they're my age? I don't know.
It's a nightmare. I was just talking about this with my husband tonight, thinking like, what's it going to be like for our children? What kind of life are they going to live? What kind of opportunities are going to be there? Is it going to be just completely run down with no future for them? This is why we have to act on it now. You know, it's very, very frightening to me. Some days I look around and it's just like a nightmare. You know, how do you handle it?
It is. Well, I vent on YouTube, but that's one of the ways that I handle it, is I get my opinion out there, and that helps me feel a little better. But yeah, and you know, I think one of the dangerous things too, and some people will say, well, who cares if whites have a homeland and, oh, you know, population shift and this sort of thing. But I think that people don't understand, well, I know that they don't understand the contribution that white people have made to the world. Our ancestors were the inventors of industry and technology. And if you just do a quick Google search and you say, you know, what person has saved the most lives in their lifetime, you know, and you look at these people who invented things like the smallpox vaccine and chlorinated water and fertilizer for agriculture, and who are credited with saving millions, if not billions, of human lives, these were mostly German and British white men. And this is, you know, where that came from. And it's a really frightening prospect globally, not just for white people, but for people of any racial background. It's a frightening prospect to think that there won't be a white culture anymore. Penicillin, painkillers, cancer research, this has all come from white people and white civilization. And for whatever reason, it doesn't come from other races and cultures. And for whatever reason that is, that's just the reality. And people need to realize that if we lose the Germans, we lose the British in particular, we lose the rest of Europe, we are losing industry and technology that is life-saving and life-sustaining, and we're all going to end up in mud huts with sticks if that happens.
No, I agree. And today's just been a really heavy day for me because I've been thinking about these things. I feel it. I feel the spirit of what's to come. And it's like you can do a political and social forecasting just looking at the path that we're currently on. And if this continues, and if there's less and less white people, and we're not around, and we don't have countries, exactly, it could go back into some real dark times. And I just worry what kind of future that's going to be for our children. Is it going to be violent? And then I'm going to be an old lady, you know, 30, 40 years from now. What's it going to be like when I'm old? Who's going to treat me well? Is there going to be a welfare system in Sweden? You know, we live in Sweden part-time, for the people who have paid taxes their whole life, or is it going to be gone? Oh. Who's going to take care of them? You know, these are thoughts that I've been having heavily today.
Yeah, exactly. I completely agree. It is frightening. And I wrote on Twitter a week or two ago, there was a hashtag about, you know, I think it was like scary ideas or scary thoughts or something like this. And I said, a world without Germans, like that's a pretty scary thought, you know, because if you look at innovation and technology, it was Nordic Europeans doing it. It's Nordic Europeans still doing it. And if we don't have them, we're all pretty screwed, to be quite frank.
That's right. That's why today we're just kind of brainstorming. I'm thinking, It might come down to people having to plan ahead, you know, live in the system, but plan behind the scenes, because things might crumble one day. You might need to get property with friends and start becoming, you know, self-sustaining and having your little kind of survivalist communities, because we can't anticipate what might happen, you know. And I'm talking not necessarily maybe in our lifetime, but for your kids. So we have to start making those plans now.
Exactly. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. My husband and I live on a quarter acre, mostly so that we can have a huge garden. We also own another acre of land for gardening. We live in an adobe brick house with passive solar design. We're getting solar panels at the end of the year. So we're preparing, because really we see this coming down and we want to preserve something for our children. We want our children to be able to get by, to be able to survive in what is increasingly becoming a third world global community as the immigration continues.
That's right. Well, I'm really glad to hear that you're preparing and thinking the same way. And I hope that a lot of other good people out there are also doing that. Well, if we switch gears a bit, I wanted to know, what are your thoughts on social justice warriors, who in my view are the nails in the coffin of Western society?
Exactly. They really are. And the social justice warrior philosophy is really what crawled inside the dead husk of white identity. When we took away the ability for white middle class people to have a strong sense of identity and pride in their culture, their heritage, their religion, and et cetera, we created a vacuum, and that happens within any community. It's not just white people. If you took away, you know, Asian traditions from the Asians, if you took away Latina traditions from the Latinos, you would create a husk of a being that feels like they have no purpose, they have no past, they have no ancestry, and therefore they have no future. And so they have to acquire an identity. It's just a human drive to acquire an identity. And right now, the only identity that's considered politically correct for a white middle class person to claim is one of these identities that falls under the umbrella of social justice warrior. And the two most prominent being the homosexuality or feminism. And both of those communities, the homosexual community and the feminist community, come with their own sense of pride. They have their own history, background. They have their own heroes of their movement. They have their own flags. They have their own terminology, their own communities, both locally, especially if you're in a larger city, and of course online. And that gives people a purpose and an identity. And they cling to that above all other things because they've been completely stripped of their real identity and an ability to feel proud about their own people and their own heritage. And then, of course, for the minorities who are not white and middle class, but are maybe Asian, mixed race, African American, etc., who are joining with the social justice warrior movement, I think it is a subconscious way of I don't think that most of them are conscious about this, but it's a way of taking no responsibility for your own life. It's really an easy way out. They get to blame, the whites or Christians or men or patriarchy or whatever it is when anything goes wrong in their life. They don't have to take any personal responsibility. And it kind of reminds me of the movie stars that when they get pregnant, they go into the hospital and they just get their automatic C-section. And so they don't have to push. They don't have to risk anything. They don't have to break a nail. They just, cut the baby out and everything else. And they completely absolve themselves of responsibility for the birth of their own child. Yep. And that way, if something goes wrong, because life is life and things go wrong, no matter who you are, where you're at, they can absolve themselves from guilt. Well, they were where they were supposed to be. They were what they're supposed to be doing. The pervasive cultural narrative is that they were following all the right rules and therefore they are completely absolved from guilt. However, if a mother was to give birth at home or without medication or took any kind of personal responsibility for her own the birth of her own child, then if anything goes wrong, it's automatically the mother's fault. And that's how our society, for some reason, seems to be structured, and therefore people want that safety net. They want that safety net of someone else to put it on. Mm-hmm. They need somebody else to have the responsibility. And so I think that's where that part of that segment of the population is coming from, as far as really gravitating toward the social justice warrior movement.
It's true what you said too, that they're cut off from anything ancient. They're cut off from any of their roots. They have no sense of spirituality. They're just like, they're just atheist, and they're just materialistic kind of mind controlled consumers. And so really this liberalism, social justice warriorism, it's a religion, isn't it? It's their form of spirituality. Yes. And they're like the new Puritans looking, we're the witches that they want to hang. The traditionalists are now the witches, right?
Exactly. And there's something about the human psyche that is set up to want a savior and a Satan. And if in the absence of having that through faith, and regardless of what the faith is, not necessarily Christianity, but in the absence of having that through faith and tradition, where you know that you're working for something and you're working towards something, that you have something that is your personal savior, in the absence of being able to identify real evil in the world, they're going to create it. Yeah, again, because the human psyche needs it. It's almost crucial for us to wake up every day. We're so self-aware. You know, we're not animals. We're so completely self-aware. We know we're going to die. We know that bad things are going to happen in our lives. We know that most likely we're going to die in a lot of pain. We're going to lose people we love. We might could lose our children. Nothing's guaranteed. And we want to create this paradigm that makes us feel safe. And so if we adhere to these new philosophies, the social justice warrior philosophies, that fills the place of where traditional values and religion should be guiding us and have guided the human race so successfully up until this point. And now they're hijacking that with the social justice warrior movement. And of course, if you look back through history, anytime a culture has deviated from what is normal and healthy and traditional and spiritual and culturally based, their civilization collapses.
That's right. I find too, talking to a social justice warrior, you never have to never back down, never ever back down. Yes. Because nature is on our side, natural law is on our side. I mean, they're really opposing what is natural, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that it's so true, you know. And of course, anytime any kind of rigorous academia is applied to this and a non-biased study is actually done, you know, it's like, oh, lo and behold, we find, wow, most women actually want to be moms and nurture children and babies. And most men are, you know, very protective and territorial and, you know, these sorts of what we would be they would be calling them now stereotypes, actually bear out to be true, that humans, you know, men and women were created differently. And within our own cultures and races, we were created to really love our own people and love our own culture and want to be proud of that and be proud of our ancestors. And I understand what you mean.
Now, let's get into feminism. So why are you against feminism?
Well, definitely the same reason that I'm against the social justice warrior movement. Feminism is one of the largest beasts within the social justice warrior movement. And it's a way for white middle-class women to feel like they have a culture and they have an expression and they've identified an evil and that they can, you know, now rid the world of this evil. They can have importance in their life. They can give their life meaning. They're not just going to, you know, go quietly into that dark night someday. They're going to make a difference. They're going to be that radical change. They're going to take down the evil, and the evil has become patriarchy. So, I have a very big background with feminism. I was a feminist, and again, it was a way of not taking personal responsibility and for my actions. It was a way of just being able to say, oh, you know, it's the patriarchy, and that's why I can't do this correctly, or I don't have this advantage, etc.
Yeah, it's usually women who haven't accomplished anything. Do you notice that? Women that don't have a good marriage, they don't have a good life, they haven't been successful. So it's so easy to just blame the patriarchy.
Exactly. And they really should be blaming feminism, because feminism is the one that's lied to them. Feminism is the one that said, delay having children until you're, you know, 40, or don't get married, and or these other things. And so they've ended up, you know, 45, childless, alone, with, you know, no family around them, no one to spend time with and to give their life meaning. And then it kind of almost emboldens them that, oh, yes, see, all this time the patriarchy was right. I'm oppressed because I'm a woman. And it's like, no, it was feminism that originally lied to you in the first place. When I was living up in near San Francisco, one of the things that I noticed on my journey to coming out of feminism was I had children, and I went about around the time that I had my third child. Women would come up to me and they'd say, oh, you're so lucky that you started young, that you started early, and that you have all of these children. And, you know, they said, well, I put off having my first child till I was 38 or 42 or 45. And they said, I didn't realize how much I was going to love it. And now I only have one child because I can't have any more. I'm too old now.
Yeah.
And I saw the pain in their eyes, the absolute just desperate pain behind their eyes, welling with tears, telling me this. And I thought, It's evil. It's evil how feminism lies to these women and tells them that they won't be happy as mothers, because they will.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think mothers need to raise their daughters to value their fertility, to value the fact that they can have children and that it's a sacred act, and they need to encourage their children to procreate and want to have families. And you're right, this feminist, it's just total BS, because really, what's so liberating about it? Women, they had to go to work. That's what happened. So now a lot of women get to have kids and go to work. I have several friends like that, because they can't afford to stay home now. That's what happened. It changed the workplace, because before it used to be there was like companies understood like a basic kind of family income. So the father would work, and it was rigged a certain way that was family oriented. But then this quote unquote liberation came of women, and it totally altered the status quo of what that was and made it more difficult for us. So now we get to go to work and have children. Thanks, feminists.
Exactly. It's completely shifted our culture in that way. And you know, a lot of people, especially on Twitter, they love to constantly, especially because my handle, A Purposeful Wife, you know, they love to say, oh, well, go obey your husband, go be a slave to your husband. And I say, well, go be a slave to your boss.
Yeah.
Like, at least the man in my life who I'm serving loves me. The man you serve at work doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, come on, it's great. You have a man that takes care of you and brings home the bacon and takes care of his children. I mean, come on. That's the ultimate, isn't it?
Exactly. It completely frees me to really express fully what it means to be a woman and to nurture and to love and to raise and to educate my children. And I'm very lucky that I found a man who's willing to do that as well, because as feminism has changed women, it's also, and culture, it's changed the men. Mm-hmm. And so many of my friends, their husbands won't allow them to stay home because they've been raised by feminist mothers and feminist culture that told them, oh, don't, you know, if your woman stays home, she's being lazy. She's not doing anything productive, you know, don't stand for that. And so now they expect their women to work. And I even have some friends with health conditions that are on disability and staying at home. And I wonder sometimes with some of them, if it isn't almost psychosomatic, because they want to be able to stay at home, yet they're not allowed to. But if they have a disability and they're able to stay at home and still receive an income, then their husbands won't bother them about it. Their mothers won't bother them about it. And they can stay at home and be mothers and do what they want to do. And of course, I'm not saying that's the case with all people on disability. I'm just saying for a few friends of mine that I have that are mothers of young children still, who suddenly, you know, around the time that they were supposed to go back to work, developed these chronic pain conditions or whatever they end up having. And I wonder if, you know, and of course they're not intentionally doing it. I'm not saying they're lying, but I'm wondering if it's a mental trick that they're playing on their own bodies.
Yeah, like an unconscious drive. They know it's something they should be doing.
Exactly. But their own mothers, their sisters, their aunts, their husband won't validate that decision to stay home with their children. And so they have to, you know, they're kind of desperately finding this workaround, their brain is, so that they can express fully what it is to be a woman.
Well, I hope there's some radical traditionalist men out there who are just seeking women who want to stay home, who want to be a mother, you know, and they need to kind of put their foot down and reject some of these feminist women who don't want to have a family. You know, that's what it's going to come down to. You know, for me, I noticed now being in my mid-30s, how much I was programmed by feminist ideology without even thinking about it. You know, I pursued certain things that, you know, careers and, you know, having experiences and doing this and doing that, and didn't even think about fem. Like, where was my head? You know, and then you look back and you realize how you were programmed here or there or picked this and that up. So yeah, I can understand there's women that just have that regret. So when they see you with all these children, I think it finally phases them. And that's awful. That's very painful.
It is. It's painful to see. And definitely, I had a similar experience as far as being raised and not realizing how much feminism was in my childhood and in my youth. And definitely when I was in college and I was a liberal and I gladly accepted the title of feminist and pursued that. That was one thing. But it was very interesting to me once I came out of feminism to look back at my childhood. And I had a mother who was a registered Republican. She was a stay-at-home mother for the most part. She had a degree in nursing, but she rarely ever worked in my childhood. And if she did, it was 10 hours a week or something very small. So she was a stay-at-home mom. She's very devoted. She cooked every meal. She sewed Halloween costumes and went to our school functions. And very stereotypical stay-at-home mom. But she acted as though she hated it. And I was raised with this narrative of like, don't you make that same choice. Don't you do this. You have a career. You are smart. You are going to go to college. You're going to get a degree. You're going to, you know, work for this company or that company. Even after when I first graduated with my undergraduate degree, my mother was just really wanted me to go to work for like the FBI. She had this just dream for me to be a linguist with the FBI. And I, right after I got my bachelor's degree, I got pregnant. Because I said, no, this is my dream. This is what I want to do with my life. And she just really was very upset about that. But it was just very interesting that even back in the 80s and 90s, a woman who was a stay-at-home mother, registered Republican, et cetera, she would never have called herself a feminist, was spouting feminist ideology constantly. And so I think, well, if that's what conservative was even back then, you know, there's no hope for anyone that's even close to being liberal to actually get the real side of the story.
And it's so annoying, too, because these European women, you know, white women, they have nothing to complain about. We have it better than anyone else in the world, you know?
Yes.
It's like, what do you not have? What do you not have access to? What is it that you want? I just don't understand.
Oh, I completely agree. I was tweeting yesterday about Jennifer Lawrence, the actress, coming out and complaining about that she wasn't getting paid as much as some of her male co-stars on the sets of movies. And I thought, you're a white 20-something-year-old American woman who's worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
And you get paid for doing almost nothing. I mean, you don't have to study or, you know, you get paid to just to be cute on film, and you're complaining. And then I thought how ironic it was too that she's complaining about this when, especially when something like Hollywood, your pay is very much based on your box office draws. And it's like, if you're not drawing the box office, sweetheart, you're not going to make the same money as the men who are. I'm sorry, do better.
Yeah. I know. And then furthermore, it's like all the technology used to make your productions was made by white guys, and the patriarchy facilitated that. So you wouldn't even have 2 cents if it weren't for that, you know?
Yes, definitely. And I think that a lot of her fan base is masculine as well. Men who think that she looks really cute, you know, with her bow and arrow in The Hunger Games. And that's where she's getting most of her money from. So the fact that she's then turning around and complaining that she's not making enough money is really sums up the catchphrase first world problems. It's like, honey, you don't have problems. You're not oppressed.
No. Yeah, and then these women that do complain, oh, these guys are making more, and then you look in the field, and it's like, yeah, they're doing these really dangerous, high risk, or yucky, or dirty jobs. They've been working at it longer, so yeah, they do deserve more money. I mean, how many women want to go work in the coal mine? Why don't they bring in more women there, or like in a sewer plant? Why aren't there more women working there? You know.
Exactly. And the men, they just simply, men have a lot of drive that women don't in pursuit of a career. Most women in general don't. And so, yeah, the men, they're going to spend the long nights at the office, and study after study has shown that women don't want to do that when it's their daughter's school play or birthday party. They're going to opt to take a short day at the office. And men notoriously, and they get a bad rap for this, don't. Men miss baseball games. They miss school plays because they're at the office and they're putting in those hours. They intuitively understand that that's their job. They don't have an option, and that it's worth more to their family for them to stay those extra hours at the office to earn more income to take care of their family. And women don't intuitively understand that because we're the nurturers. So our idea of taking care of our families to physically be there. And if you're physically there, you're not at the office.
That's right. So, Well, to pick on women some more, I really enjoyed your video called Welcome Refugees, I Blame Feminism, This Is Why. And I agree, women are completely pushing for multiculturalism, this one world, no borders, just, you know, general liberal insanity. So let's talk about why you blame feminism.
I blame feminism because, as we were discussing a moment ago, it's radically changed our culture. So women were given the right to vote 100 years ago, and we've done nothing in general but thrown away our votes. We vote for these expensive, bloated social welfare programs, again, because it's our nature to be compassionate and to love and to nurture and to want to take care of people. And when that people is an entire country or even an entire world, we'll vote against our own best interests. Men aren't like that. Men are logical and more calculated than women tend to be. And when they're going to the voting booth, they're thinking about what's in the best interest for themselves, their family, their nation. And sometimes, well, and men very much understand that that means that we can't take care of the world, that we can't be the moms of the world and take care of everybody and give everybody a teddy bear and a lollipop. And they understand that. They understand that there are hard choices to be made, because they do. They make those hard choices, like missing their son's baseball game in order to spend more time at the office because of the cost-benefit analysis of that. Men make those decisions quickly. They make them every day. This is why they're much better at chess than women tend to be, and things like this. They're calculated. They understand that. They understand it politically. And when men were in charge of politics and in charge of national security, they made those logical, calculated decisions, even if it meant some people starved. And they understood it. Women don't. We will sacrifice ourselves. We're notoriously self-sacrificing. We'll sacrifice ourselves, our homes, our children, unfortunately, our families, our futures, because we want to love and nurture. And it's great within the home for a woman to be self-sacrificing and saying, oh, I want to go to bed early, but I got to stay up to sew my son's costume for the school play tomorrow. That's wonderful, and it works great within the sphere that women are naturally good at, because they will self-sacrifice for that. They'll lose the sleep, but their son has a wonderful experience and a great memory, and that's terrific. It doesn't work on the national stage, which is why women just are, they haven't been in power and control throughout history politically. They aren't very good at it when they are. And so the feminist idea, these feminine ideas of nurturing and loving to the point of completely self-sacrificing, have not only influenced women voters, who therefore vote for weaker men, but it's influenced the men as well. And so we get these people in positions of power, even when they're male, who are basically feminists, even if they wouldn't call themselves that. And so they're making decisions based on feminine feelings. And they have to go back to their constituency. They have to go back to those soccer moms and justify what they did politically. And they politically need to pander to these groups of women. We're also very loud. Women are very opinionated. We like to tell people what we think. Men are a little bit more reserved that way. They wait to offer their opinion when they're sure, and it's more calculated. And women just kind of, we're always just expressing our feelings. And so we're doing that at our politicians, and they're making those decisions based on us just constantly venting at them about our feelings.
And women seem to think that the money's never going to run out, you know, it's just like spending in the welfare state. Oh, it'll be there, you know. Yeah, I notice men, you know, they've gotten soft because of this feminist ideology. Exactly. So they're not protectors of the land like warriors anymore, because this is completely unnatural. I mean, it's not refugees coming into Europe. That is utter bullshit. You know, it's just like it's a third world invasion of people coming in. And it used to be in the old days, people would protect the land. They wouldn't allow this invasion to happen. But yeah, they've gotten soft. They've let go of that warrior instinct. They've let in this liberal, you know, feminized kind of man think coming in. And now we're paying the price for it. So I wonder, do you think that men are going to, that warrior instinct is going to kick on if this invasion is continuing in our lands?
I definitely think it will kick in. The question is whether it's going to be too late. The question is really whether it's already too late. But I definitely think that our base instincts, the way that we were created, if you believe in a God, or the way we evolved, if you don't believe in a God, is those base instincts are going to kick in. That self-preservation, particularly for men, that warrior will kick in, but I'm really afraid it's going to be too late. I'm very inspired by the men that I meet on social media, though, who have taken on that mantle of protector and warrior, who will openly say, you know, publicly, no, I'll kick in the door and I'll save the day. And hopefully that becomes more popular in the mainstream, and more men feel empowered to be able to take back their warrior status. But as I said, I think the biggest question is whether or not it's going to be too late. Because if I'm in rural small town Utah and my street is already half Latino, you know, we've got about one generation left as far as saving this country as a white country.
Yeah, it's, I know, it feels like it's lost because at the rate that they're coming in, and I saw there's buses now, Homeland Security is basically smuggling in from Mexico, Muslims.
Yes.
And there's been lots of footage of this. We're talking thousands coming in. It's like, I married a Swede. He had to go through the process. It was long. It was expensive. It was hard. Now, these people just say the magic word refugee or asylum, and they're in. They don't have to pay the fees. They get all this welfare. And it's like, wait a minute. How is this happening? You know?
Yes, exactly. And it seems, I mean, you can't help but think that there's a calculation behind it, because why would that be? You know, and I remember going to high school with a boy that was from Poland, and his family had recently immigrated from Poland just the year before. And I was used to only meeting immigrants from Mexico and South America. And so I kind of figured he came over the way most of them do. You know, you kind of just come over illegally and then hope everything works out, because it will. And just do your paperwork later. I had a friend from El Salvador. Her parents came over illegally. You know, when she, 12 years later, they finally got their paperwork together and became citizens. But no, he was telling me about how he, you know, it was years and years. His parents actually were on a lottery, and they had won, like, basically this Polish lottery to be able to come to America and to actually even get the opportunity to file the paperwork to come to America. And it really struck me at how hard white people from white countries have to work to get in here, even if they're scientists, doctors, lawyers, even if they have something really great to contribute to our society. But pretty much anyone can come across our southern border with brown skin. I think it would be very interesting to see if to get a huge group of white people and try to see if they can sneak across the southern border and see if anyone will actually stop them.
Yeah.
I kind of suspect that they kind of would. It would be like, oh, wait, this isn't what's supposed to be going on.
I know. I thought about, how about we, you know, smuggle in a bunch of South Africans from the squatter camps. I don't know if you're aware of them. And like, they're not getting refugee status. Bring them to Germany and say they're refugees. They need our help, you know. Or what about the Ukrainian kids that are, you know, there's lots of refugees there. Would they be accepted into Germany? I don't think so.
Oh, definitely not. Definitely not. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. And then here's the scary thing. We have a lot of low birth rates among European women. And obviously, this ties into feminism. What are your thoughts on these low birth rates?
Oh, it's horrible. It's horrible all the way around. Obviously, it's not good for white people, because if you're not having babies, there's not going to be any more white people, particularly when we have so much immigration in both America and Europe. And so you're looking at only a couple generations out before there literally are no more white people. But I think it's really horrible for women themselves, because women in general have a desire to be mothers and to be mothers of large families, I think, as well. And I talk to my friends often about this, and I was just speaking to one of my friends a few days ago about this, and she's had fertility problems. So she has one child who is 8 years old, and she hasn't been able to have another child. And being a mother for her is really hard. Just having that one child, you kind of end up being that child's only source of entertainment. You end up being that child's constant playmate and companion, and that can be exhausting. Mm-hmm. And she was explaining her everyday kind of life, and I thought, oh, that just, I couldn't even do that. But here I have five children. It's because they entertain each other. They play together. Large families are actually a lot easier to have than people think, but they've been demonized, and they've been demonized particularly by the environmental movement, which is another, you know, add on to that social justice warrior movement where people feel like they're saving something and they're preserving something. So they get fanatical about it. And so they get fanatical about not having babies. And of course, it's always, you know, the white countries they're telling not to have the baby.
Yeah, exactly. They're not telling the Mexicans or the Arabs coming in to have less babies.
Exactly. And they're having a lot of babies, and we're not. And we have to break down those. As white women, we need to be breaking down those taboos around large families. We need to stick up for each other. If a woman is being, you know, if you're in Walmart and you see a mom with five kids and your friend kind of snickers to you and says, oh, you know, looks like her life's hard, or makes a derogatory comment, we as white women need to start standing up and saying, no, her life looks really fun.
Yeah.
Imagine how much love that household has, or some other positive comment. We need to be turning this tide away from shaming big families, particularly white families. And we need to encourage white women, not only for the preservation of our culture and our race, but for their own health and their mental health and their physical health. The more, study after study again has shown scientifically having a lot of babies is really good for women. It lowers our risk of cancer substantially, just overwhelmingly lowers our risk of cancer when we've had multiple babies and when we've breastfed for a long time. And of course, our hormone levels, our mental stability, you know, women without children tend to have high rates of depression, et cetera.
They get neurotic. You notice that?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It's because their body isn't doing what it's meant to do. And it would be like, you know, using your nose to push pennies across the floor instead of breathing with it, breathing only with your mouth and only using your nose to push pennies across the floor. It's absolutely insane. If you were doing that, people would say, you're crazy. Why are you doing that? That's not what the nose was meant to do. And women who aren't having babies who aren't getting married, they're doing that with their whole body. They're using their whole body not as it was intended. They're not doing the natural, normal thing. And then, of course, they end up having high levels of estrogen because they're having too many menstrual cycles, and it's jacking up their rates of cancer. And they're, you know, getting into their 40s and 50s, and they're dying of breast cancer.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. We have a friend who, she's in Sweden, and she has eight babies. She's one of us. She thinks like us, and she's a beautiful Swedish woman. So I'm glad she had eight children, but she gets snickered at and looked at and judged, and it's just so awful. So I make a point too when I see women with large families out smiling and saying hi and telling them how cute their kids are, and they're always shocked. They're always shocked meeting someone like me that's like smiling and accepting of that, because I see other women with lots of kids when they're kind of walking around the store, you know, with all their kids. They almost look like ashamed when other people look at them. Yes. Have you noticed that?
Oh, definitely. And I felt that myself when I had my third baby, and my third baby was less than a month old. And I was very proud of him. And I, you know, I loved him so much. And I was so excited to go in public with my beautiful family. And we ended up needing to take a trip into Oakland. And so we went to Oakland one night. We went to the Whole Foods market there. And I, you know, here I am, and I'm feeling great about it. I have my little baby, and he's so cute. I've got my other two toddling along, and we're walking through the parking lot, and this social justice warrior woman, a baby boomer, started yelling at me and also with the friend that she was with about how horrible I was, that no one needs three children. She actually counted my children very dramatically. She says, 1, 2, 3.
Oh my gosh.
Who needs three children? You know, no one needs that amount of children. And I was too shocked to have come up with a clever response at the time. I just kind of slinked into the Whole Foods. But I remember being very self-conscious after that about my family size. And thinking, oh my gosh, here I am. I was really proud of my cute little kids and my family. And now I'm thinking, is everybody thinking this way? And the more I started paying attention, they were. I ran into a woman at a thrift shop, and I actually, my kids were in the car with their dad, and I was just running into the thrift shop really quick to pick something up. And there was a woman in there talking to a man about how horrible it is when women have children at all. Having children at all right now is a horrible choice, and this and that. And I thought, my goodness, if I was in here with my kids, you know, what would she be saying to me? And women do, they feel ashamed. And I live in Utah, which is the land of big families.
Yeah.
I mean, we have big families out here, but I still get that even in Utah. I mean, I got it everywhere I went when I was in Northern California, the land of the social justice warrior. I mean, I was always getting, you know, looked at and stared at.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I lived in Hollywood. I worked in the business there. And I remember once 2 years went by and I didn't see a kid. And I just realized, I was talking to my friends. I'm like, do you realize I haven't seen a child in 2 years? And then they were all like, yeah, you're right. I haven't seen a kid either, you know?
Yeah, that sounds like the plot line of a frightening Star Trek episode, you know? Like, yeah. They go to a weird planet and they're all, you know, they're in the planet conversing with people for a few moments and realize there's no children.
Yeah.
That's always when you look at stories and storytelling, that's always a bad sign that we've got to that point in our civilization and nobody's looking around going, where are the children?
Yeah.
But you're right. Yeah, and that was the same in Northern California. You could spend days in the city, particularly Oakland, San Francisco area, and never see a child.
Well, I wonder if that awful lady who came up to you, hopefully she doesn't have any kids. Hopefully she's not passing on that mentality. And I wonder, would she go up to a Black family or a Mexican family or an Asian family and have said that?
Yeah, probably not. I can't imagine. I, you know, we have a high Latino population here, and I've never witnessed anyone confronting a large Mexican family about their size. But they love, you know, with white people, in particular with us Mormons, you know, it's considered totally cool to tease us about our large families and how backwards we are.
Well, you brought up a interesting thing earlier, made me think of the sisterhood, you know, and I'm always saying, where is the sisterhood? I've been meeting some great women doing the show and talking about these issues that I feel is really pulling us together in a different kind of way, a different kind of strong folk spirit, which I appreciate, meeting some very solid women. But what is your idea on where is the sisterhood and why have white women become so shallow and why are they judging each other so much? Why can't they be tight like some other ethnicities, non-white ethnicities are?
Yeah, I think, again, it gets back to us not having a cultural heritage and a pride about our culture and not being allowed that. And I think that when you see the sisterhood amongst Black women or Latino women, it revolves heavily around their culture. And I'm thinking of the movie Soul Food, which is about a Black family and their experience. And when I was young, I loved that movie. And I couldn't quite put my finger on what I loved about this Black movie. I mean, it was made for Black people, about Black people. I'm not Black. I keep watching this movie and loving this movie. And it was because it was about soul food. This family got together, the sisters in particular got together every Sunday, and they met at their grandma's house after church, and they had their traditional Black Southern dishes that they would eat, like egg pie and collard greens, and they would talk and laugh. And anyways, and they had that bond. But white women, we don't have that bond. You know, Latino women, they have these great parties, these quinceañeras when their daughters turn 15, and they have all these wonderful cultural traditions that they celebrate, and it creates a natural bond and it creates a sisterhood. And white women, for the large part, aren't allowed to have that. And I'm very fortunate to be Mormon and to be LDS, particularly in Utah, where we have a high LDS population. And because the LDS women are very much into sisterhood. They take care of each other. They support each other. But because they have a shared culture and a shared heritage, they have a shared faith and they have shared value system. And so it lends itself to them easily getting along together and supporting each other. But white women in general, middle-class white women in our country in America, don't have any shared values or shared heritage. They can't, no one's going to bond over, you know, going to a jewelry shop and finding a Norse design on a necklace or something. You know, white women aren't going to be like, oh, wow, look, it's our culture. It's our, you know, they're not going to have anything to talk about or do. And so, yeah, they end up just caring about their pedicures and getting their hair and their nails done. They don't have anything to fill that void, and they don't have any reason to talk with other white women about
anything. I think it's especially bad in America because we've been cut off from our motherland, our homeland, so we don't know our old culture, you know, and we're cut off from those old roots. And we also lack a racial and an ethnic and a folk consciousness. Black women They very much have it. I mean, that's why when you say sisterhood, I also think of like a Black movie, right? You know, and that's really sad but they all have that one thing in common. They may fight, they may judge each other, but when it comes time to it, they support their own Black sisters or their own Mexican sisters. And that's something us white girls need to start doing.
Exactly. And we will just, you know, especially within social media, white people and white women in particular will just turn on other white women. There's absolutely no idea of solidarity there at all. The second they find out that I'm a Christian or that I'm a anti-feminist or, you know, any of these things that the social justice warriors don't like, the white women turn on me immediately. And they say, you know, they say, this is why people want to kill white people. This is why white people are horrible. It's because of people like you. There's no solidarity there at all. And what I think is interesting is if you look at the two different types of white people, there's the people that care very much what other people think. Those would be your typical kind of, you know, your stereotypical cheerleaders in high school who spend a lot of time on their appearance. They want people to like them. They want to be popular. And then you've got the white people that are very geeky and have grown accustomed to not having to care what people think of them. And those geeky types, they will unite even if people think they're being silly. And where one of the places they unite is Renaissance festivals. And Renaissance festivals are really like this undercover way for white people to feel proud of them.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
So this is why I think Renaissance festivals are so popular. You know, almost any town that you go to is going to have at least one every year here in America. And, you know, it's almost even a stereotype, and you see it represented in media and culture and things like the Big Bang Theory. And people get really into it. I mean, there's people that base their whole lives around following Renaissance festivals around or working at Renaissance festivals and producing goods for Renaissance festivals or learning, you know, blacksmithing or something like this and leather work and tanning. And it's like this subversive way to have white pride.
I like that. Yeah, I also see a big comeback in like Norse tradition and myth, Odin gatherings. It's a very spiritual thing. You know, I think we should be bringing back these old traditions and celebrations and just really heavily bring it back and have our kids grow up with it so they know what these things are. So it's ingrained in them. So they get excited about it like Christmas. You know, remember how excited we get about Christmas? But wouldn't it be great to get excited about like Leif Erikson Day or some important Norse commemoration or something, right?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I homeschool my children, and so I'm allowed to, I kind of have the time to put a lot of thought into our family traditions and our family culture. And one of the things we do is that we do celebrate, like we, you know, May Day is a really big, or Beltane or however you want to phrase it, is a really big celebration in our family. And, you know, we do a maypole. And we do a dance, dance around the maypole, and we invite our friends. And some years we don't get any friends come. And this year we had about five other families come to the park with us and do a May Day celebration. I make sure that we have our ethnic foods that we'll eat. You know, I make things like Zwiebelkuchen and German foods, and we do St. Lucia Day, and you know, we do it the Swiss way, where the Swedish way. You know, we make the saffron buns, and mm-hmm. we have those rituals and those European rituals. And I often chuckle to my husband. I said, you know, when our kids grow up and they get into the real world and they start having their own families, my sons are gonna turn to their wives and say, well, what are we doing for May Day? And their wives. What's May Day? What do you mean?
Yeah.
No, yep. Seriously, you got to get a pole and you got to get some ribbon and you got to do a dance, and their wives are going to think they're absolutely insane.
That's funny. Well, maybe they'll marry some other people that are also raising their kids in this similar manner.
Oh, I hope so. I really hope so. And that's kind of something I'm just kind of, you, as a mom, I have to emotionally let go of. Obviously, I can't control who my kids fall in love with and who they marry, but that's definitely on my heart all the time, that they'll marry somebody with similar values and similar traditions that, or at least a woman, at very least, for my sons. I have three sons, and then my two daughters are quite young. But so I've thought a lot about my sons and their future so far. And at least if they could just marry a woman that is receptive to those ideas. I'll take what I can get, you know, and hopefully be able to see some traditions and some cultural identity and pride carried on to my grandchildren. But intellectually, I know that I can't obsess over it because the way things are going and love being as it is, my sons and my daughters may just end up, you know, going a different direction.
Yeah, you know, I think, though, you could bring, you know, their spouses in the future, you can bring them into the fold, you can expose them to these traditions. And I think it will activate and real reawaken something in there. It's a spiritual experience when you activate with the old things that our ancestors used to do that are ancient. And I think people are hungry to have something to hold on to, hungry for a spirituality and a union. So I think they will be very receptive to it. I think you'll be surprised more and more. They'll probably just start popping in, you know?
Yeah, hopefully. Culture is much like a pendulum, and it rarely settles in the middle. It tends to swing one way or the other. And so since we're swung so far left now, I'm hoping that we're in for a right swing, a swing back to some more conservative and traditional values here very soon, and it won't be such an odd thing.
Well, before we close, I wanted to, maybe you could share some of your ideas on unschooling, what type of education you're giving your children, any tips for any other homeschoolers out there?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, homeschooling has to be such a unique and individual family process. And there's a huge learning curve to it, too. So I would tell moms, don't give up the first couple of years just because it seems hard or you feel like you don't know what you're doing. Because again, it's one of those things where you're taking complete responsibility for yourself. Whereas what's normal in our society today is to give your children over to this state-run education. And if your children can't read, well, it's the teacher's fault or whatever else is going on. So you're taking on responsibility and that can feel really heavy. But be kind and gentle with yourself and allow yourself to have a few years, at least, you know, the first 3 or 4 years, to really get your groove and understand what works for your family culture. But my thoughts, particularly on unschooling, I think it works wonderful for about half of a child's education. I think that if you kind of think of their education as being half and half, unfortunately, I think when unschooling is the entire of a child's education, unless the mother is incredibly detail-oriented and incredibly meticulous about making sure that they're getting those experiences every day, it very easily devolves into just kind of chaos. And children do learn on their own, but only to a certain point. There's definitely something valuable to more classical education as well.
Yeah, they need order. They need structure. I think that's good for humans. We crave that.
Exactly. And even things like rote memorization, which get a bad rap these days, but just having them memorize things also is very good. And so I personally kind of do half and half. I create a curriculum. I create my own curriculum, but it's based on the Waldorf method, which was developed by Rudolf Steiner in Austria about 100 years ago. And I use that method to decide which subjects I'm teaching to my children at which age, and then I gather my own curriculums and resources in order to teach those subjects. So, for example, one of the things they do in fourth grade that's taught is Norse mythology. So that's their main lesson a lot of the time. So they're reading about the Norse myths and they're writing stories to go along with that. So their math assignments even are based on word problems from Valhalla or something like this. And so you kind of this whole experience and there's different themes every year, and because it's European and it's really wonderful and helps me enrich my kids with those traditions. They study the authentic, in first grade, we're doing the real Grimm's fairy tales. We're not doing the Disney version. We're doing the real German version of Grimm's fairy tales and things like that. It gives them a sense of culture and heritage. And I think that's an important thing to instill in your child when you're doing homeschool, is a family culture and a sense of pride. Both in the fact that they're homeschoolers and in their personal heritage. Because being homeschoolers, they're going to get teased a bit. They're going to be a little bit ostracized. It's not a normal thing in our culture. And they need to feel a lot of strength around that and a lot of pride around that. They need to understand why their family is doing that. And so I like to develop a curriculum. I write it up over the summer for the grades coming up and kind of give an outline for each day that we're going to be, that we go through. But our curriculum usually lasts, it's about about, you know, from about 9 a.m. until noon. And then after that, I really love to just let them do unschooling for the afternoon and pursue their own personal passions and interests. So my son right now is really into cartoon drawing and animation, my 12-year-old, and he picked that up totally on his own and has really been running with it. And particularly the days of the internet, they can learn anything they want online. And so that I just kind of let them run free in the afternoons and develop their own personal talents and gifts that they've been given. And that's kind of how it works for us.
Wow, that sounds great. I love that. I know people always write me all the time, you know, we need some tips. What do we do? So it's good to hear from you. So I'm really glad that we got to meet. But Ayla, please tell everyone about Wife with a Purpose and any other closing thoughts that you have.
Yeah, well, I tweet over at A Purposeful Wife and over on Twitter. And I also have a YouTube channel. And my YouTube title is Wife with a Purpose. Or I think it's YouTube/user/AdorableAyla is the URL if you want to go there. And it's not a professional polished YouTube channel. And I love to tell people it's raw. It's really raw. It's really who I am. I sit down with my computer and I share my heart and my thoughts and my feelings. And sometimes my 3-year-old sticks her head in and says hello. I don't edit that out. It's just, I really want to show people what it's like to be a mom and a stay-at-home mom of a large family, and so I cover a lot of different subjects. I talk about my faith in some of the videos. I talk about political issues, feminism. You're gonna get a lot of different ideas from the randomness of my brain.
Well, I really appreciate your time today. It's been fantastic, and I really enjoyed meeting you. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed my time here as well.
As a woman in her 30s who got a late start on the trad life, I want to encourage other younger listeners to make family your number one. I look around and I have friends in their 40s who are single with no children, and I see the emptiness starting to phase them, the regret. You see, they didn't have mothers that taught them of the importance of a good man and a strong family. They were victims of the onslaught of propaganda saying that marriage is death and kids are captivity, all men are assholes. They weren't taught how to find the right man, and they weren't told that when you have that man, life becomes richer and more fulfilling. I know from speaking to various women that many of our mothers weren't satisfied with their own lives because of poor decisions, and so they pass that mentality down to their daughters, projecting their experience, but that is a cycle we have to break. I've noticed people who have spent many years alone get a little weird with finicky habits they've picked up through the years, with no one to say, hey, what are you doing? They haven't been challenged to craft themselves and chisel away to become a finer human being. For me, that's important to have. My other half challenge me and spot me in areas I do not see. And there's a unique dynamic between the healthy feminine and masculine that really propels you to new heights beyond what you could do on your own. I fully understand that women want to have careers and get stuff out of their system, but create a realistic timeline so your window of opportunity doesn't pass you by. And just because you have children, it doesn't mean you can't do those other things at some point in your life. Use your younger years wisely. Fertility is the ultimate gift, so honor it. Let me be that voice telling you, prioritize family, because the family unit is what will fulfill you, and it's what will carry your genes into the future so you can continue to exist on this planet. If you don't leave a legacy, what's the point? Radio314.com or redicecreations.com is the website where you'll find our extensive radio archives, videos, news, and our social networks. That's it for now. Have a great night.